This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT, Houston, KPFT.
Chances are you already recycle paper, glass, and plastic, but it's just as important to recycle old rechargeable batteries. They're the kind you find in power tools, cell and cordless phones, laptop computers, digital cameras, MP3 players, and other cordless electronics. If it's rechargeable, it's recyclable. You can recycle your old rechargeable batteries at any of the thousands of retail stores that have joined the nonprofit Call to Recycle program. Those include home improvement centers, electronics stores, and other retailers all across America. To find a participating drop-off location, call toll-free 877-2-RECYCLE or visit us online at calltorecycle.org. Recycling old rechargeable batteries is easy, it's free, and it's a great way to do something good for the environment. Just remember, if it's rechargeable, it's recyclable.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Polinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on this evening's program, I'm sure that you've heard the name Harvey Milk. Well, there's a movie coming out about the story of his life. And wouldn't you know it, a couple of our local celebrity types, Ray Hill, and perhaps even another special guest will stop by to talk about what it was like being there at the time when all that stuff was going on. And the Bayou City Performing Arts is going to be doing something for the holiday season, and Colleen Fisher will be here. And we have, of course, News Wrap and This Way Out, and then leading off the show this evening, none other than Jerry Simoneau is here, and Jerry is going to talk with us about what it was like to be with about 600 other people who were gathered in front of City Hall to express outrage at the passage of the same-sex marriage ban in California. And it happened not just here, but in other cities across the land and across the world. And so with that...
Well, I'd like to thank Jerry for coming in. As Glenn was saying, we had a... national and international event happen around the world in protest of Prop 8 in California. And joining us is Jerry Simoneau to talk about his role in this protest in Houston.
Well, this was an amazing protest. You know, it came about in less than a week's time. I think I first found out about it probably on Wednesday. And we did this on Saturday, which was an incredible. The most incredible thing about it really is that it took place in I don't know how many cities throughout the U.S. I heard 140 as the lowest, over 200 as the highest, and you can even find protests that took place all over the world even.
And it was timed to happen at the exact same time. And here in Houston, it was at 12:30, but it was 10:30 in California. So that was the cool part. It was kind of a movement around the world.
It was a wonderful ad hoc grassroots movement in which no one was really in charge, but everyone took up the mantle.
That was the coolest part. All these different organizations, community organizations, were there kind of shoulder to shoulder in protest, and then the people came and supported and had the greatest signs. But
how did the organization occur? You're talking about nationwide, worldwide.
Yeah.
Did somebody just wake up one day over a cup of coffee and say, you know, let's have a protest?
Well, no, it wasn't quite like that.
Sounds like the 60s.
Yeah, perhaps a little background information for some who may not be familiar with Proposition 8.
There are a few people that just woke up.
In California, right. Proposition 8 was a voter initiative in California to amend their constitution to eliminate the right to marry from their gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender citizens who were in same-sex relationships. This amendment did pass, and it was amazing that it had passed. It's not so much that a voter initiative amended their constitution to take away rights, But it happened on the heels of a California Supreme Court decision in which the Supreme Court in California declared the right to marry is a fundamental right of every citizen, no matter what your sexual orientation. You have a fundamental right to marry. Not only that, but the decision went on to say that lesbian and gay people, they didn't mention bisexual and transgender people, but lesbian and gay people were a distinctive class of people that were worthy of protection from invidious discrimination, which happens against lesbian and gay people and certainly bisexuals and transgenders. So we have a class of people whom the Supreme Court said need extra protection. We have a fundamental right, and then all of a sudden we have 18,000 people in same-sex relationships getting married in California, but the voters of California took that away. That was outrageous. That was outrageous. This is the first time that we've ever really amended a constitution that went into the constitution, stripped away equal protection, stripped away a fundamental right from people who had secured it properly in the court system. That's what was outrageous. That's why these protests took place on one day at the same time all around the world.
Is it over? I mean, they passed it. It's a referendum. Is it over?
Well, it ain't over till it's over.
I
is
know.
It?
Well, I was hoping you'd say that. But
yeah.
It seems to me that there's more to it because
there is.
You know, granted, they don't teach civics much anymore in our schools, but I remember from my schooling that we learned a lot about civics, something about the right of the many suppressing the few.
Well, that's one of the problems with this voter initiative is that, and this is what Lambda Legal and the National Center for Lesbian Rights have claimed in their petition to the California Supreme Court, is that what happened here is not a mere amendment to their constitution. An amendment would be something that furthers the intent of the constitution. What happened here was a complete revision of their constitution, not a mere amendment. A revision would mean that a fundamental right that had been found in the constitution was now stripped away. Now, to revise the amendment in California requires a two-thirds supermajority vote in the legislature. It does not require a simple majority, which is merely an amendment to further a right.
Okay.
So that's what Lambda Legal and NCLR are claiming in their petition. And there's a big reason for that. When the framers of the Constitution were thinking about majority of people voting on the civil rights of a politically unpopular minority, that's when they decided we need to put a guarantee of fundamental rights into the U.S. Constitution, and we need to add to it a guarantee of equal protection under the law into the Constitution.
Right.
Everybody gets equal protection. And equal protection means that I will subject myself to the same laws as I expect you to be subjected to, and that I will receive no special treatment. But what happened in California is heterosexuals have now received special treatment under the law. So they have special rights. They have the special right to marry. And gay and lesbian people or people in same-sex relationships are being denied that right.
Isn't that very similar to what during the pre-1950s when it was actually illegal for interracial marriages? That's the same thing.
Well, it's very similar. Before 1967, there up to 40 states at one time had laws that said that you could not marry someone of a different race. So there was a race prohibition, a race discrimination in their marriage laws. And the United States Supreme Court said that you cannot discriminate based on race in marriage. And what we're saying here is the analogy is you cannot discriminate based on gender in marriage. So there is an analogy there.
Where does that stand now? Is it sort of on its heels? I know we had a protest to bring attention to that. I know it was very painful for our entire community worldwide, especially nationwide. If there was one state we felt that was
the state. I mean, it's very
that
depressing.
Would be there and stand for us as far as the population is concerned, and when it didn't, it was a little letdown for everybody.
Especially Texas.
Well, you know, the protest was an admitted expression of pure outrage.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't expect to change the law because of a protest. We don't expect that a court is going to decide our way just because of a protest. We were just so angry that we had to let this out somewhere. And we had to do it as a community. And, you know, it really is an outrageous idea to think that a person's civil rights can be put to a vote of a simple majority of the people around you. If we did that on any of the civil rights advances that we have had over the last 100 years, we'd be back where we were in 1900, because no one would have voted, or it would have taken a very long time for people to vote on civil rights. That's why we must rely on the protections in our constitutions to make sure that our civil rights are guaranteed to us and protected.
Well, and at one point, women couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and you know, a gender discrimination. And at one point, only property owners could vote in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things have been changed in the evolution of our nation and through the amendment of the Constitution.
Jerry, why is marriage important? Why not civil unions? A lot of my friends are saying, well, if we had the exact same rights, why not have that? Why, in your opinion, is it marriage at this point, and why are we as a community uniting for marriage?
Well, first of all, let's understand that it was not the GLBT community that first started this marriage question. It was those who opposed the GLBT community who began the question of marriage, and we simply jumped on board and said, well, if this is going to be a fight about marriage, then let's get in the fight. The answer is this. It's exactly what the California Supreme Court decided in California when they were talking about people who had every single right as heterosexual couples, but they had to call their relationship a domestic partnership. All the laws were still the same, but they couldn't use the word marriage. That extra label automatically puts them into a different class, and we don't know why. I mean, we understand that that's offensive, but there's even more to it than that. If we take our domestic partnership outside of California, how is that going to translate to any other state? What does that even mean? And how do we explain to our children, and I have a son, how do we explain to our children that your daddies or your mommies are in a domestic partnership because we're not good enough, or we're not level enough with the rest of society to be called a marriage? Marriage in law, marriage in our statutes, is not a religious institution. It's not a religious connotation. And let me give you an example of why. Christopher and I have been married for 21 years. Our marriage is recognized by our church. Our marriage is recognized by our family. Our marriage is recognized by our community and by our leaders in the community. It's just not recognized by the state, but it is a marriage nonetheless. That is a religious marriage. What we're talking about, though, in law, is civil marriage. It has nothing to do with religion. It's a word that has a meaning in law.
Yeah. Hasn't this whole question been an evolution from... at one point, marriage was really, you went to church, you got married, whoever you were, and then you took this little note from the minister and went down and you registered it with the county of your residence, and it didn't have any other connotation. The only thing was to register to make sure the children of that relationship were legal children. They weren't, you know, born illegally. And how did it get to where you've got half a country ready to, you know, burn the other half because of it? Over a word.
It is a word. It's
it is a word, but it's a word that has a religious connotation.
Mm-hmm.
It's in some faiths a religious sacrament that has nothing to do with law.
But you touched on something, Jennifer, that makes a lot of sense to me and to a lot of other people in and out of the legal profession. In Western Europe, and in Mexico, for example, in Latin America, for example, you have two different ceremonies. You have a religious marriage. You go and you get married in your church, your synagogue, your temple, your house of faith, house of worship. But you take that to the government and you register that with the government in order to receive the rights and protections and law of the laws of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if we had a bicameral kind of system in marriage here, that would be fine. That would be, for example, civil unions for everybody. But if you want a religious marriage, then you go to your house of faith, in order to receive that. That would be fine with me. But marriage, and it's because of Henry VIII, really, in the Marriage Act, that we have marriage that is combined, religious marriage is combined with the state. And there's a long story behind that, and I don't know if you have time for me to go into it.
So we'll save that one for another show.
Now, Jerry, let's talk about the event itself, kind of the people that put this together, people that were there, in case our listeners weren't able to attend. It was a beautiful day and a beautiful event.
It was a beautiful day, and I can tell you that we got 642 confirmed names, so I know there was a minimum of 700, over 1,000 perhaps.
Probably 1,000.
Let me give a shout out, if I can,
some
of the organizers. These are folks who really worked hard on this. This was Josh Verde, Paul Hidalgo, Megan and Lindsay Baker, Victor Castillo, and my partner Christopher Bound were just some of the people who worked really hard all throughout the week to make sure that this came about.
There was also a number of organizations that were there.
There was Equality Texas and Paul Scott out there in Austin. Thank you, Paul and Chuck Smith out there. The Houston GLBT Community Center, a local ad hoc organization that was started by Megan and Lindsay Baker called Impact Houston, and a little organization that Christopher and I founded for 6 or 7 or 8 years ago called the Foundation for Family and Marriage Equality.
Been to some of your events. Tell us more about the event itself. I unfortunately was out of town on Saturday, so I missed it.
Shame on you, Jennifer.
Well, we talk about that. If I'd have looked hard enough where I was, they may have had one.
They had them all over the state.
Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you about it. It was packed. It was absolutely packed with people at City Hall. We had wonderful people such as Ray Hill, the father of Houston GLBT, the civil rights movement. Garnet Coleman and Jolanda Jones and Jessica Farrar were all speakers there. The Reverend David Keyes, a minister at the First Unitarian Universalist Church, was there. And he was surrounded by other ministers such as Reverend Pete Estrada, Pastor Lauren Groen. And we had a Buddhist minister there. I can't remember her name. I'm sorry. John Netchman, a local attorney and civil rights activist and wonderful speaker, was there. We even had couples who are Texas couples but who were married in California talking about their experience. Mark Eggleston and Darren Brindle, as well as Megan and Lindsay Baker, they were both there. And, you know, what they're saying is, I was married in California when it was legal, and I understand that this proposition now says that the state of California can no longer recognize marriage, but what does that mean for me? Well, the Attorney General in California, Jerry Brown, said that he is going to defend those marriages, those 18,000 marriages that took place.
Yeah.
However, here's the problem. If the government, by its constitution, its contract with the people, is now barred from recognizing those marriages, what would happen if a California same-sex married couple went to court to get a divorce? The court might say, you know, we're constitutionally banned from recognizing your marriage, so we're constitutionally banned from enforcing any right or obligation under that marriage, and so we really don't know if we can do a divorce. You might have to do like they do in Texas. Pretend you had a general partnership business and dissolve it as if it were a business.
Oh, my God.
That's what we do in Texas. It's very humiliating.
Yeah.
You don't even get into divorce court. You get into business court, and that just blows their mind.
A civil court. Oh, my gosh.
One of the best speakers, I thought, is Lisa Lett. If you're out there listening, I want you to know that your speech brought tears to the eyes of many people. Lisa and Teddy Lett are the parents of a gay son who is in a relationship and whose spouse, whose partner they recognize as their son-in-law. And that was very moving to hear a parent talk about that love and that connection with her son and her son's partner. And then, of course, I spoke at the end. I wound it up and told everybody to go home.
Well, you know, and two, it all comes down, and you touched on it a moment ago with the Letts, is that it's about love.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the government saying who you can love, and that's as basic as it gets. And that's a shame. That's a shame.
There were so many great signs.
We've been relegated.
There. You know, I was at the event, and I loved the signs, and one of them was, when do we get to vote on your right to marry?
Exactly. That's exactly what this is about, is that you cannot vote on somebody else's civil rights.
Exactly.
You know, and here's the thing about marriage. Here's what everybody needs to know. Marriage is about love. It's about relationships. It's about commitment. It's about a lifetime promise to take care of each other and to be responsible for each other. Marriage, as recognized by the state or the government, gives tools to help that couple take care of each other and be responsible for each other. And without those tools, you know, we have to go to lawyers, we have to draw up papers, and there is no lawyer in the world that can reach those 1,138 federal laws that automatically apply to a same-sex, to another marriage.
One of the things, while I was traveling, by car, and the woman who I was traveling with asked the question, what's the big deal?
Oh, my God.
And we spent 2.5 hours in the car, just the two of us, discussing exactly what we did. And when it was all said and done, she said, what can I do to help? So I ask you, what do we do now to help?
Get engaged. Get engaged.
But
get engaged.
I'm not even dating.
This is what I mean by that. Get engaged in a community organization. Get engaged in a political organization, such as the GLBT Political Caucus. I think you're aware of that
one, aren't you? Yes, she's a very good organization.
She's heard that one.
Get engaged with a great candidate. Get engaged by becoming a candidate yourself. But whatever you do, get engaged. That's what you can do to help.
Okay. How can we get in touch with someone if they need to get more information?
Well, I think one of the places that you can go to is, let me give you the website for my foundation.
Okay.
It's www.familymarriageequality.org.
And I'm sure Equality Texas, they're working for us. They're our lobbyist in Austin.
Oh, absolutely. EqualityTexas.org is a great site. If you want to follow the case as it wends its way through the California Supreme Court, you can look up LambdaLegal.org or NCLRights.org.
And then there's a website, is it called Join the Impact?
That's right. JoinTheImpact.com. Yeah.
All right. We want to thank you for being here this evening, and this is Queer Voices.
And coming up soon on Queer Voices, Ray Hill and Ed Barnes to talk about the new movie about Harvey Milk. But first, news wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 15th, 2008. After 9 years in power, New Zealand's Labour Party lost its majority in national elections on November 8th. The right-leading National Party won 59 seats in the 121-member parliament. Labour won 43. The Greens won 8. The Progressives took 1. And 2 minor parties took 5 seats each. There will still be 6 out gay or lesbian MPs in the new parliament, the same number as were elected in 2005. With the leadership of supportive Prime Minister Helen Clark, Labour steered a National Civil Unions Act into law in 2004 and abolished discrimination against same-gender couples with additional legislation in 2005. National Party leader John Key will become New Zealand's 38th Prime Minister. Retiring openly gay MP Tim Barnett told GayNZ.com that the incoming government worries him and that he hopes the Nationals won't attempt to roll back the progress achieved under the Labour Party. There will be a number of MPs in the governing party who do not have a great deal of tolerance for lesbian and gay New Zealanders, and some of them used homophobic themes in their campaigns, he said, so there's good reason to be nervous. He said that Parliament's equality agenda is not now so much about changing laws as changing practices in government departments, the province of individual ministers. He said he doubts that there will be many National Party leaders who'll be prepared to stick their neck out to be friends to our community.
But 2 measures extending hate crime protections to gays and lesbians have been adopted by the Hungarian Parliament, according to a report this week by the British-based PinkNews.com. A hate crime will be defined in a more general way as a violent act against a member of a social group, which is believed to include sexual orientation. The second piece of legislation makes it possible to initiate civil proceedings against a person who engages in degrading or intimidating behavior towards groups based on nationality, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation. LGBT activists in Hungary have clashed with police in recent years, and pride events in the country have been violently attacked by right-wing and religious fundamentalist groups. The hate crimes provisions are part of a wider bill on the protection of public order. Government officials reportedly shied away from mentioning LGBT people and the hate crime elements in the explanation of the bill or in the parliamentary debate. Hungary's socialist government has adopted several bills in recent years to sanction less severe forms of hate speech, but all attempts have been struck down by the Constitutional Court as violations of free speech. It's therefore uncertain if the new laws will pass judicial muster.
Some 230 activists from 40 nations gathered in Vienna in early November for the 12th annual conference of the European region of the International Lesbian and Gay Association, or ILGA. Attendees included the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, Thomas Hammerberg, Austrian President Heinz Fischer served as an honorary patron of the gathering, and Austrian Minister of Justice Maria Berger attended the opening session. Vienna Mayor Michael Hoppel hosted a reception for delegates at City Hall. ILGA Europe's 2009 conference will be in generally less welcoming Malta, and the 2010 meeting will be in the Dutch capital of The Hague.
The long battle to overturn India's colonial-era ban on carnal intercourse against the order of nature, Penal Code Section 377, may finally soon be resolved. The Delhi High Court has been hearing arguments and reviewing legal briefs since the case was first filed by the NGO HIV/AIDS Prevention and Sexual Minorities Advocate NAS Foundation 7 years ago. The court ordered the petitioners and the government to file transcripts of their final oral arguments by November 17th. Section 377, which punishes offenders with up to life in prison, has rarely been enforced in modern times. But LGBT advocates say it's been used by police and extortionists to target sexual minorities for abuse. The judges have not said when they'll announce their verdict.
Connecticut became the third U.S. state this week to open civil marriage to same-gender couples, just 8 days after California voters repealed that right. Connecticut and Massachusetts are now the only two states where gay and lesbian couples can legally tie the knot. The Connecticut High Court ruled 4-3 in October that the state constitution's equal protection guarantees demand marriage equality. One of the plaintiff couples in the 4-year legal battle was among the first to get a marriage license on November 12th. Reporter Melinda Tojos was on the scene for Free Speech Radio News.
Barbara and Robin Levine Ritterman were among the 8 same-sex couples whose victory at the Connecticut Supreme Court in September legalized same-sex marriage. The court ruled they had a right to equal protection under the state constitution. The couple had a commitment ceremony 16 years ago, and then were joined in a civil union when that became available in Connecticut in 2005. But standing on the steps of New Haven City Hall, amidst white balloons, red roses, and supporters wearing big pink I Do buttons, Barbara said that wasn't good enough when she went to the hospital for a cancer checkup.
When they said, "What's your marital status?" I said, "Civil union." And she said, "Oh, there's no place for that in the computer. I'll put you down as single." Which just made me feel like I was back up there when the chemo almost killed me and worrying whether if I got sent to the intensive care unit, was Robin going to be able to come with me?
The Levine Rittermans haven't set a wedding date yet. But later in the morning, a lesbian couple that was not party to the lawsuit got married at City Hall. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
A partial tally from 130 of Connecticut's 169 cities and towns counted 66 same-gender couples who had applied for marriage licenses during the first 2 days they were legal.
The battle over California's Proposition 8 continues even after Election Day. Demonstrations in cities and small towns across the state, in some places where LGBT rights demonstrations have rarely been seen, have literally been held every day and night since California voters on November 4th approved the measure to eliminate the right of same-gender couples to civilly marry. An unprecedented national day of protests in as many as 300 cities are taking place across the U.S. as we record this newscast. In what gay journalist Rex Walkner has dubbed Stonewall 2.0, thousands of younger lesbian gay people in particular are becoming activists for the first time, and they're organizing protests using Facebook and other social networking sites online. Meanwhile, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has become a specific target of LGBT anger as thousands have demonstrated at Mormon temples in Los Angeles, San Diego, Oakland, and at LDS headquarters in Salt Lake City, Utah. Mormons in several western states, in addition to California, provided massive financial and organizational support for Proposition 8, as they were urged to do by church leaders. Depending on who's doing the estimating, from 7,500 to 15,000 New Yorkers jammed the streets outside the Mormon temple in Manhattan to protest on November 12th.
Some LGBT leaders have questioned the targeting of Mormon church facilities, while others have justified those demonstrations by arguing that the LDS Church can't use religion to claim immunity from protests over their political intervention in what critics call a civil rights issue. They're free to believe what they wish, but the well-documented church advocacy of Proposition 8 stepped over the line, protest defenders say, when Mormons wanted to impose their religious views about marriage on the entire state. There have been reports of a few minor incidents of vandalism at some church buildings, and the No on 8 campaign issued a press release this week condemning any actions that aren't entirely peaceful. But they also pointed out that up to half of all the money raised to pass Proposition 8 came as a direct result of Mormon church actions. In fact, a report surfaced this week documenting an internal church memo in 1997 that urged the defeat of marriage equality efforts across the country. Then LDS President Gordon B. Hinckley was quoted as saying that Mormons needed to move ahead with the church's opposition to legal same-gender marriage.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was on record as being opposed to Proposition 8, although he didn't actively campaign against it at all. He nevertheless said during a CNN interview this week that he hoped lawsuits that have been filed challenging the constitutionality of the voter-approved marriage ban would be successful and encouraged gays and lesbians who've been protesting its passage to never give up. But in an email to supporters this week, Tony Perkins of the right-wing Family Research Council condemned the governor for condoning street protests and supporting judicial activist scams to overturn a popularly approved state constitutional amendment, and said Schwarzenegger was approaching advocacy of anarchy.
43 members of the California legislature, including the leader of both the Assembly and the State Senate, have filed a friend of the court brief in support of the legal challenges to Proposition 8.
And finally, openly lesbian rock star Melissa Etheridge has also spoken out against Proposition 8. In a blog posting to the Daily Beast this week, she announced that passage of the marriage ban means I do not have to pay my state taxes because I am not a full citizen. Etheridge also questioned attempts to legislate morality. Gay people are born every day, she wrote. You will never legislate that away.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 15th, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Rick Watts.
This is Queer Voices.
Gay rights activist, friend, lover, unifier, politician, fighter, icon, inspirational, hero, his life changed history. We're talking about Harvey Milk. The film opens on November 26th. All of us here got to see a preview of it, actually the full movie, but they've asked us not to actually review the movie because they're waiting for the big wigs to put their the official reviews.
Why, Jack, is the film going to open on October 26th? That is the anniversary of his assassination.
And it's the day before Thanksgiving this year. It falls that way. It's to give it a long weekend also, I guess. Sean Penn stars as Harvey Milk, and there's just an incredible cast there within the film. Well, in the studio with me is, of course, Ray Hill and my good friend Ed Barnes, who both knew Harvey. And I'm just going to throw it open to you. Ray, actually, Ed, you lived a block away from his store.
Right. I lived at 541 Noe. Harvey was at 541 Castro.
That's Rockwell's Market Street, actually.
A lot of us, when we got on the number 8 Castro bus in the morning, we rode with Harvey. I rode to One Market, Southern Pacific, and Harvey, of course, rode to City Hall on the number 8.
And tell me some of the memories you have of Harvey.
Well, before he became an activist, he ran this camera shop. And it was definitely the hippie era, folks. Overstuffed couches.
Not very clean.
And right. And dogs laying around all over the place. And a lot of old people, senior citizens. Harvey had a very loving relationship with the old folks in the neighborhood. The Castro at that time had a lot of single senior citizens. And he was very kind to them. And it was like a gathering place. It really wasn't a camera shop. Well, they did do a couple rolls of film, maybe a couple times a day, but the place was always filled with neighbors and just shooting the breeze. And he was just a delightful. He was just one of the funniest people I ever met. And when he got elected to office, one of the first things he did is he... For the senior citizens of San Francisco, he made mandatory the seats in the front of the buses because of Harvey Milk were restricted to senior citizens.
Yes, things we take for granted now.
That's one of the things that he did.
Well, and some of us actually use those seats.
Yeah, right. I was thinking just, I was only 34 years old. Hell, I'm 64 now. And
did you see it as changing history at the time?
Oh, I knew it was changing history. I mean, because of Harvey Milk, I came out to my family. I came out to where I worked at Southern Pacific. I mean, that was really something for... I mean, when I retired...
For that era, even for San Francisco to come out at the office.
Oh, yeah.
Enormous thing.
This is 1977.
And I'm proud to say when I retired, I was Assistant Director of Labor Relations for Southern Pacific, then Union Pacific, and Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and I was openly gay. Because of Harvey Milk. I mean, not to review the film, but the film was very true to history. It was absolutely true. Everything I saw in that film was true. Except I really thought that Harvey was much better looking than Sean Penn. Much more beautiful smile. Well, but other than that, he caused people to... I mean, one of the things he always preached, which is also portrayed in the film... is we have to let people know who we are. Otherwise, if they can't identify with a gay person, we're never going to get anywhere. And he stressed that. And so I came out to my family. I was fearful of losing my job at Southern Pacific. And come to find out, half the executives in the company were gay. And I'd argue board cases and find out that half the neutrals I argued in front of were from Harvard and were all gay. And, I mean, he just opened up the world.
Well, and at 1977, when he, or a little bit earlier that, when he moved into the neighborhood, it was not necessarily a total gay neighborhood. It was
No, it was
changing.
Very much a blue-collar neighborhood. I remember there's a bar that's even shown in the film called the Twin Peaks. At the corner of Castro and Market, and it was painted black windows you couldn't see in it. And it was like a blue-collar laborer-type bar where everybody went, and suddenly the gays started moving in the neighborhood, as Harvey did. You learn that he took over the... He fought the merchants who didn't want any gays, but the whole neighborhood pretty much turned gay, and Henry Africa suddenly became... The Twin Peaks suddenly it was the first gay bar in history, probably, in San Francisco to, you could drive by and look in the windows. And they had ferns hanging, you know, and, it was a total new movement.
One of his first coalitions he also built was with the unions.
Oh, absolutely.
And he got Coors out of the gay bars.
Well, it was rumored that Coors, well, it wasn't rumored, they were discriminating against people.
Howard Wallace was the leader of the AFL-CIO, and Howard was openly gay. And he didn't make the movie, but Howard got the head of the AFL-CIO to join Harvey Milk's campaign, but only after the gay community had successfully boycotted Coors. And considering how much beer gay people drink, that was like a heavy knot on the head, and they just can't make up for that kind of loss in the other sections of San Francisco, because they literally did what we did in Houston. They set it out on the sidewalk and let it sweat in the sun.
Well, there's so many gay bars in the United States, you can imagine. I can remember you couldn't find a Coors beer. I also remember, because of Anita Bryant, you were lucky to find a glass of orange juice in a bar. And if they did have orange juice, they all had signs. Our orange juice comes from California.
Texas or California.
Nothing came from Florida. And the Florida Citrus Commission finally fired her.
Yeah, well, actually, they also shipped their orange juice over here to be sold as Texas orange juice. I caught them doing that. But the Harvey Milk that I knew was not my neighbor. The Harvey Milk I knew was an activist.
And he was not necessarily the establishment person in San Francisco in the gay community.
No, he wasn't. He was kind of an irritating guy. The established gay community, meaning the people with money and investments and all of that, the established gay community preferred anybody but Harvey Milk. First place, he had long hair and he had a beard and he was kind of a hippie-esque character. He left New York in 1970, and the arc of his life was the quote that I've seen, not just in the movie, but several other places. I'm 40 years old, and I've never done anything in my life that I am proud of. 8 years later, he died. The first thing that he did was he was liberated from the establishment in New York and moved to Dallas. Actually, that's not in the movie. He moved to Dallas, and he worked in Dallas for a while. But Dallas was too stuffed shirt, too preppy. So then he went to San Francisco because he said there were hippies in San Francisco. And those are people he liked better. He moved to San Francisco. He did provide the leadership to change Castro from a working class mixed population. But the thing about the senior citizens, it's just like when gay people came into Montrose in Houston, the largest population group in Montrose were retirement age women living alone in the houses their husbands had bought off the money they made off of Texas oil. And so our largest population was senior citizens. And gay people and senior citizens are a mix. I mean, number one, they've got nice garage apartments, or they can cut the house up into housing units, and we can live there. And m'lady needs somebody to carry to the grocery store, and more importantly, to the polls. So our political strength was taking our landladies to the voting polls and giving them our endorsement card. The history of the evolution of Houston is not that much different in time, space, and effect as the history in San Francisco.
It should also be noted that Harvey ran for office three times and lost.
Three times and lost, yeah. And the real fight was election by district. That was the real fight. And when he got the by district election, then he was a shoo-in. And another thing that
people, and that's the same thing that happened in Houston.
Yeah, but we didn't elect people by district. Our openly candidates have always been elected at large. Right.
Anise Parker, Sue Lovell.
But Houston had the same history in that originally council was elected at large, all of them.
Oh, yeah, and yes. We got a lot of criticism, number one, for the caucus being very committed to by-district election. But then who filled those vacancies were our dearest friends. And so we had the option of running at large successfully or running against our dearest friends. So we ran against our enemies, and that was successful. The other thing is that not only election by district, but we also, there was another important change in Houston, was term limits. As long as we were on the outside, there was no way to get in. So we, the Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, now Gay, Lesbian, Transgendered Political Caucus, GLBT Political Caucus, got together and we supported term limits. And oh, our old established friends, they said, why are you doing this horrible thing? But guess what? That meant that they cycled out of sure. their positions and gave us room to get in. Now that we're on the inside, I wouldn't mind relooking at the issue, but when you're on the outside, you've got to be in favor of those kind of reforms. I met Harvey Milk in Dallas in 1978. We had a famous debate, and it was tape recorded by Dave Lamble. I was up there to give a speech on how to utilize the media, and Harvey was there to give the keynote address to Texas Gay Task Force Conference, which is what the whole state did for Pride Week in those days. And so we were up in Dallas, and Harvey said, look, I heard about your idea of the National Lesbian Gay Congress. I want you to support the march. And I said, well, and I complained about the march. So he said, let's discuss it. So we went to Dave Lamble's house, and Dave turned on a tape recorder. And Dave will not up that film. I guess we're going to get it after he dies. But, I mean, that tape. But there is a reel-to-reel tape of my debate with Harvey Milk over that. Harvey won the debate. I agreed to support the march. He agreed to follow the following year with the Gay and Lesbian Congress. And then we come to Houston. And another thing about the era is there was enormous competition. Harvey was the first openly gay male elected to public office. Statistically, you got to remember that Elaine Noble had been elected to Massachusetts House of Representatives before Harvey. But Harvey was the first. And in the same election, Brian Coyle of Minneapolis was also elected, but Brian wound up in a runoff. So Harvey became the first, and Brian became the footnote to Harvey. And there was enormous jealousy there. And so Brian and Stephen Dean, the founder of HRC, invited Harvey to come to Minneapolis to have the first March organizing conference. Well, Harvey went only to find that it was a trap, and the conference voted not to march. Solely because it was Harvey's idea. So Harvey returned to San Francisco, and I have my second conversation with Harvey. He calls me weeping and saying, it was a trap. They sabotaged the march. I said, don't worry. We've got holidays coming up. Let's get through the holidays. I'll host a conference in Houston where I can control the votes, and we'll vote to march. And then Dianne Feinstein comes on national television and says Harvey and Moscone have been assassinated.
Yes, that was... People don't realize that when the shots rang out, Dianne Feinstein was the one who ran into Harvey's office and found him. And the horror that...
Was it Harvey's office or Dan White's office?
No, she ran into Harvey's office.
Yeah, it happened in Harvey's
office. Dan White escaped.
At that point, yeah. Dan White didn't have an office.
Right.
Oh, that's right. He resigned.
He didn't have an office. He had already cleaned his office out.
Just to get back to the film for a minute, the film is connected with a tape that Harvey is making. And it's very true. I think it was when they were lying in state, Moscone and Harvey, both in City Hall. They played a tape that Harvey had made because he always had a premonition that he would be assassinated. And I kind of wept through the film because it is that exact tape that Sean Penn is, it opens, the film opens with him reading and making the tape.
It's sort of the narrative throughout the film.
Well, it's not just a narrative, it's the real thing.
Yes.
And Harvey's tape was played at that memorial service. And
I never talked to Harvey that he did not mention his being assassinated.
And it was, it starts with, there was a boy, a guy from Altoona. That's how I remember it. And truthfully, I pretty much wept through the entire film because it brought back such memories of such a loving human being. That's how I saw him. And the pain that so many of us felt and the horror that someone went in and loaded 5 shots into the mayor, reloaded his gun, went into Harvey's office and shot him 5 times.
Well, of course.
And then he got off with like a 7-year sentence.
He did.
On the Twinkie defense. And then what people don't realize is that Dan White got out of prison after 5 years. And it wasn't 2 years later that he committed suicide by locking himself in the garage and killing himself. And yet the ironic thing is he had a defense of the Twinkie defense of being, you know, a psycho. And yet the entire time he was in prison, he did not get 1 minute of psychiatric help or counseling. And he caught, and the tragedy of this hero,
of course,
being shot down.
Of course, those of us who know about prison, there is no psychiatry for anybody in prison. And Twinkies was a defense used in that case. Very good lawyers. It immediately, most states passed legislation to prevent that from being used again. But it didn't make any difference, because this is the deal, and Harvey had a premonition about this. Harvey always thought that Dan White was one of us.
Yes.
Harvey's gaydar went off, and he knew that even if Dan had killed him, that wasn't the queer that was giving Dan White problems. Dan would ultimately have to take care of the queer that was causing him all that misery, and that was himself, and he did that. That is not an infrequent theme. I mean, how many times have I had to point out that 40% of the people who commit violence against gay people are themselves gay? And the demons that they wrestle with are the demons that we need to find answers to in the interest of our own safety. And that's talking about closets. Harvey Milk did not say, organize, organize, organize. Of course, he did that very well. Harvey Milk said, come out, come out, come out. And that is the answer to all of our problems. At the demonstration Saturday, I noticed that there were a bunch of respectable members of the gay, lesbian, and bisexual, and transgendered community sitting on the podium with me about to speak, and their companions were lost in the crowd. That's not the way to do this. So I got up and called them by name, told them to come up and join their companions on the stage, because we can no longer afford to be closeted about our relationships. If we want relationship, marriage, equality, we're going to have to value our relationships. And that means be seen as a couple when we go grocery shopping, be seen as a couple when we go to our office parties, be seen as our couple when we go home to have holiday dinners with our families. We're going to have to come out and come out and come out. And guess what? Harvey was absolutely right, because 30 years ago, we were wrestling against Proposition 6.
Oh, yeah, the Briggs Amendment.
The Briggs Amendment.
And that was?
And we won that. That was a drastic, everything you can imagine against gay people was stuffed in there somewhere. And we won that, and how we won it is people followed Harvey's leadership and came out in the thousands, tens of thousands, and people knew us, and they voted for us, and it was even a shock election night that we had won that but we won it by coming out of the closet. And if we want marriage equality, we're going to have to come out of those marriages, relationship closets in large numbers. Well, even our good friend Deborah Bale was up there saying, bride wannabe. She said, I don't have a companion, but I'll take one if you can help me get one. So it is Harvey Milk is more than an icon. Harvey Milk is more than an example to follow. In my speech, I invoked both Harvey Milk and Socrates. Those are the two most outstanding queers I can think of in Western civilization.
Yeah. One thing in the film that's going to move a lot of people, of course, is the ending. And in the ending, they show the actual candlelight march.
Yeah.
And I was in the front of that march. And you could hear a pin drop during that whole march, except one guy dressed in Hawaiian outfit was on a balcony blowing a conch shell like a death. And I remember walking all the way from Castro down, and when we went to turn on Van Ness to go to City Hall, I looked back towards Twin Peaks, and as far as you could see, there were thousands of people with candles, and not a sound could be heard. And when we got to City Hall, at the end of that candlelight vigil, there's a statue of Lincoln in front of San Francisco City Hall, and everybody put their candles on it and was covered with wax. I don't know, it was just symbolic, but like I said, I wept then, and I tear up even thinking about it now, because he was such a loving human being that was a gift to every gay person and every lesbian around. A quick note on the Briggs Initiative, there was also a lesbian that she and Harvey debated Mr. Briggs, and her name was Sally Gearhart.
Yeah.
And I was sorry that she wasn't covered in the movie, but she was probably better than Harvey debating that idiot Briggs. And another thing in the movie I noticed, Senator Briggs had a very distinct lisp. And if anyone ever looked and sounded like a queen, it was him, but that was not portrayed in the film.
Well, the
But Proposition 6 went down big time. That's why I was sad about 8.
Well, it really wasn't decided until the San Francisco vote came in. And
yeah,
the San Francisco vote was the last one. And so it didn't so much go down big time. It won handsomely.
Yes,
our side won handsomely in that.
And all the polls says they were going to lose it.
Yeah, all the last minute polls say we're going to lose it. And they were gathered around, and the David Goodsteins, the publisher of The Advocate, was going to blame the loss on Harvey, which had a real advantage because politically, it's not in the movie, but politically, David Goodstein had to give the credit for the victory to Harvey, because it was Harvey's personal drive to just occupy the campaign when they said, no, we're not going to bring up the gay issue. Duh. Doesn't that sound like Houston's 1985 referendum? We don't want to talk about gay stuff because that turns people off. We should have come out of the closet. We should have followed those ideas in Houston in 1985. We didn't, and we lost.
Well, you predicted that before.
They nailed me to the floor. They wouldn't let me go anywhere. I finally said, look, we're losing anyway. Why don't you let me go debate the religious nuts on their radio? And they said, why would you want to do that? You can't get any votes. I said, well, I can't lose any there either. So,
besides the film that's opening up this Wednesday, a week from Wednesday, November 26th, at Landmark's River Oaks Theater, there also is a documentary out that's very good called The Times.
It's been out for a while.
Been out for quite a fact. It won an Academy Award.
Academy Award, right.
And there's also the based on the book by Randy Schultz,
right.
The Times and the Life and Times of Harvey Milk. It's a very big book, yeah. Very thick book.
And you know, I would encourage people that are interested in social change to get all of the books, study the script of the movie. I mean, I'm an seasoned old activist. I've been at this a long time. I didn't get here automatically. I got here because I studied the work of Gandhi. I studied the work of Martin Luther King. I studied Malcolm X. If you're going to change society, you need to study the people that have done that. Harvey Milk did that. The amazing thing about Harvey Milk's career is it spans 8 years. 8 years. And when you think about it, where gay people were in the mid-70s and where we are now means a remarkable distance has been covered in a remarkably short period of time. I'm a professional at this. This is not my only movement. I was in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I was in the civil rights movement. I was in the early part of the women's movement. I've been mother inclusion all of these years. And change can happen, but it depends on creativity, which is best illustrated by studying Harvey Milk's work, what he did, and how he did it. And then study the other people that have brought about change. Harvey Milk is right up there with Chavez, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, right up there.
Gandhi,
right up there with Eleanor Roosevelt. Other people that have affected the society in which they live in a positive and progressive way. And it is 20 years from now.
Yeah.
Harvey Milk will be academically studied more seriously than now, because right now we have to see him through our tears.
You're listening to KPFT Houston. Ed, you want to?
I just say I hope every young GLBT person out there makes a point to see this film, because if you don't know Harvey Milk, this film will teach you and you will learn. Thank you.
And you'll also learn that Sean Penn is one hell of an actor.
Yeah.
Yes, the entire cast is
the
very...
entire cast.
So the film opens up Wednesday, November 26th at the landmark River Oaks Theater, and probably some other theaters throughout Houston, but that's the centrally located theater. And Ed Barnes and Ray Hill, thank you very much for sharing some of your moments and memories of Harvey Milk. You're listening to Queer Voices.
music to celebrate Harvey Milk, suggested by J.D. Doyle, Frustrated Housewives, and a song called Believe. Don't worry, I haven't actually flipped my wig. I know it's a little bit early for Christmas music. This is kind of a lead-in to the Bayou City Performing Arts, and those folks are with us now.
That was an excellent segue.
You know, there's nothing like Christmas music to get you in the mood for Christmas.
In the spirit.
In the spirit. In the little cool weather. That also adds to it. In studio tonight, we have the bubbly Colleen Fisher.
Joined
with myself, Brian Lavinka, and
Jennifer Renee.
The lovely Jennifer Renee. So, Colleen, there's a concert coming, if I understand.
There is. There's actually three concerts coming.
Three
up.
Concerts?
Three.
Pray tell. Tell us
well.
Now.
First, we have our ladies busting out in the Christmas spirit and the holiday spirit on Saturday, December 6th, and Tuesday, December 9th, they'll be performing at their new performing venue, Unity Church, on the west side of Houston.
Right near my home.
Yeah, huh? And we're asking people to come on out to the west side and check out an absolutely unbelievable venue for our women's chorus. And they're going to be singing, their concert is entitled A Wish for the World.
Mm-hmm.
And James is, and the musical staff has put together an outstanding group of music that just kind of focuses on angels and sort of spiritual healing for the planet and just kind of good, really, you know, lining up your chakra kind of vibes for a great holiday concert and getting some good energy out there. But really some great energy songs like Boogie Woogie Santa and just some stuff that's going to catch you a little off guard. So, just a really well-rounded holiday concert.
Now, when did they move out to Unity? Is this going to be a regular venue for them?
At this point, yes. We were at Bering, and we were really enjoying the space over there. We'd been singing it, my gosh, between the men and the women, we'd been singing at Bering for, gosh, I want to say like 7 or 8 seasons.
As long as I can remember, you've been coming on for sure.
Yeah, and we loved our little home over here in the Montrose and singing there with everybody. But we were noticing that our crowds were getting bigger and, you know, instead of necessarily adding more performances, and the parking got to be kind of problematic. And
what parking?
There's streets you can park on.
Yeah. Exactly.
And walk.
I've been there at election day. I know there's no walking.
So we decided that, you know, while it was an absolutely strong and incredible relationship with Bering, that we would just try to see if there was a new, possible new home for the women's chorus. And we have a lot of singing members that are parishioners or... at parishioners, I'm Catholic.
Members,
so
obviously.
Members, exactly. I'm feeling guilty already.
Say your Hail Mary.
Yeah. Pray God and no Fina.
And so the members of Unity Church, there's a lot of singers who are members at that particular church, and they were like, why don't you come and look at Unity and see how it is and see what's up? So we went over there, and we were blown away.
Isn't it a beautiful facility?
Gorgeous. And we actually
had... The acoustics are incredible.
Unbelievable. State-of-the-art lights, beautiful video screens, just an unbelievable setup over there, you know, really welcoming, 800 seats in the bottom section, mm-hmm. just tons of room so that everyone can spread out and enjoy themselves. And hopefully, with any luck, will be so many tickets sold that everyone will just be all family-liked up together and sitting next to each other. And it's just going to be a great way to start and, you know, checking in on the holiday season.
Is this the first time they've used this facility?
Yes. This is the first time that BCPA will... Yeah, we performed there a couple of years ago. A choir member's partner passed away, and we did a service there, so we were familiar with the space. We had the great honor of singing at his memorial service.
Okay.
So we were familiar with the space and familiar with what it could do and the beauty of it. And so then from there... It was just a matter of talking with them and getting it past the parish staff that, yes, you know, come on in. We welcome you with open arms. And the staff has just been outstanding. And Howard Caesar is the leader.
Minister?
Minister, thank you. Yeah, wow.
Padre.
Exactly. Batting 1,000 tonight. Way to go. But he's a truly wonderful, wonderful man, and his staff is absolutely outstanding, and they've all just been so supportive about us moving over there and performing over there.
Okay, I'm not familiar with this place. Where's this at exactly?
This is, if you go down 59... Mm-hmm. Are you heading south on 59? You're mm-hmm. going to get off at Hillcroft, and it's right near the Hillcroft and Westheimer intersection. It's actually on Unity Drive,
okay.
And you can get to it off of Richmond, or you can get to it off of Hillcroft.
Okay, I'm not. Is that?
It's across from the Richland post office. Don't
is that
you
like
know?
HEB over there is that?
The HEB is actually at Fountain View and
okay,
Westheimer.
I don't ever go out that far west.
Okay,
so
let me. Okay. Hillcroft turns into Voss. So if
okay.
you've driven around, you've gone to the REI on Westheimer.
Yeah.
It's right, that's the intersection I'm talking about. It's got
okay.
the Barnes & Noble, and it's got the Boston Market and
okay.
the REI. And you come, it's just south of that intersection at Westheimer and Hillcroft.
Yeah, between Westheimer and Richmond, right there
okay.
on Hillcroft.
Yes.
There's a stoplight, and there is Unity.
I got you.
So, and it's we have a picture of
lots
the church.
Lots of good parking.
Fantastic, well-lit parking. Plenty of it. It's wonderful. And we've got a picture of it on our website, so you can see what the outside of it looks like so you don't miss it as you drive by.
It's a portion. It's the church with the pyramid.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and
yeah.
they have their new sanctuary, which
yes.
is a part of a pyramid.
I see.
So, and it's just, it's this beautiful white facade. Fantastic. So tons of windows, you know.
Very good.
Yeah. And so then after we break out the holidays with our women's chorus, the Saturday the 13th, we're going to be performing for our fifth year at the Festival Institute at Round Top. In Round Top, Texas, near Brenham.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we get some amazing audience members from the surrounding community. It started out so tiny a few years ago, and it has just blossomed and grown into numbers that we could have...
Now, where is it in Round Rock?
It's in Round Top.
Round Top, I'm sorry.
And it's like 10... It's at the Festival Festival Institute. At
okay.
Round Top.
Is that like New Brunsville area?
No, it's not. It's like right near Brenham. It's
Brenham.
Like
Brenham.
An hour and 20 minutes, maybe an hour and a half, hour
okay.
45 minutes.
I understand it's a nice venue there.
Gorgeous. Unbelievable
what's that venue
what they've
like?
Done. Well, it's an old, like a German... It's all German influence, like German architecture and craftsmanship, and the wood is all hand-carved and just beautiful seating. And for a long time, before I started with the organization, they've been working on fixing it up, and at one point, I think someone was telling me there was cement floors and white garden chairs.
Uh-huh.
Well, then they went and they did the most gorgeous hardwood floors and beautiful wood inlays you've ever wanted to see. I mean, the architecture and the work that went into it is just unbelievable. And so then they did the hardwood floors, and they still had the white garden chairs, which was always just very funny. And then this last year, we got in there in beautiful red velvet seats.
Oh, my.
Gorgeous.
And ever so gay.
Yeah, so gay. And James Dick is the artistic director out there, and he is a...
Is he one of us?
He is, as a matter of fact.
Designer James.
Did you have to ask? The red velvet.
The red velvet chairs. But a beautiful, amazing pianist, and has a tremendous musical group out there, teaches classes, all kinds of different things. Well, they've invited us out now, this is our fifth season, of bringing us out to be the featured holiday concert at that
wonderful
particular venue. We get folks in from Austin, mm-hmm. we get some folks up from Houston, and there's really a tremendous community in the Round Top and Brenham area that comes out to support us. We have a board of director has... a house in the Round Top Brenham area, and she puts a blurb in the Round Top newspaper, and we get everyone coming out, and it really is just a fantastic afternoon. The show is at 3 o'clock, and we sing until about 5:30. They always put a tremendous little cocktail party on for us afterwards, and we get to meet and greet the audiences out there, and it's really just an awesome family experience for us to go out there every year. We're very, very lucky. And then rounding out our holiday season is we're going to have our men's chorus at Jones Hall. I know, I'm so excited.
That's my favorite concert. And,
it's really an annual holiday event. We're really excited. So we're going to be bringing Winter Song is our men's concert name this year. It's our concert title. And we've commissioned Robert Seeley, who's done a piece for us in honor of our 30th anniversary, because this year is our 30th anniversary.
30 years.
The men's chorus has been kicking around for 30 years.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's exhilarating, and they're sounding amazing this year.
And you weren't even alive when they started.
I sure as heck was. Don't insult me.
She was just very young.
I leave out certain details.
Yes,
I see. This is by far my favorite concert. There's always a production, and it's just always campy and fun.
And this year is not going to be one to disappoint. Let me tell you, the guys are putting a lot of effort in. There's actually a piece based on Stomp, the musical Stomp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were rehearsing it tonight. I was just at Covenant Church where they were rehearsing it before I came over for the interview. Unbelievable. It's going to be fantastic. We call it choreography.
Oh, that's funny.
Yes. The choreography is going to blow people away. They're doing a hands-down, bang-up job. It's going to be outstanding. So, and there's just a... there's a lot of little pieces. There are going to be some really great moments to the show. So we're looking forward to entertaining everyone over at Jones Hall. And that's Tuesday, December 16th.
I still remember maybe 3 years ago, the Jalapeno Chorus at the concert, the Christmas concert.
Yes.
The Jalapeno Chorus?
Jalapeno.
I'm not going to sing.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
It was so good.
That is good.
Yeah, and if anyone remembers the Silent Monks from a couple of years ago doing the Hallelujah Chorus, they're back this year. Break out your cue cards, folks.
Yep. That is wonderful.
Yep. So we're bringing back the Silent Monks. So there's going to be a lot of stuff that people remember, but a lot of new stuff.
So how do you get tickets to that?
You can go to our website.
Okay. Good segue, Jennifer.
It's excellent. Well done. As always, our tickets are available over the internet. So you can always go to our website, and that'll take you. We've got a new shopping cart this year, so buying tickets is easier.
Tell us
a little more intuitive.
Let's let our listeners know the website.
Website is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
.org. Yes.
So I think you can't get there by .com, not .net, .org. And you'll get there. Or just Google us, because we're one of the first names that pops up.
No, it's the same thing for the women's chorus, too.
Yes.
Get tickets from there.
All tickets can be purchased online. You can also call our office at 713-521-7464. And an easy way to remember that is 713-521-SING. you can give us a call. Isn't that precious?
Was that by accident or by design?
You know, I wasn't there when the decision got made, so whatever it was definitely intervention.
Cosmic intervention.
Cosmic intervention. I love that. That's good.
Now, what if we have listeners out there that are musically inclined and feel the need to sing outside their showers?
Hey, showers, steering wheels, they don't just deserve to hear. You need to come on out and need to sing with the chorus. Our next open enrollment period are going to be the Mondays and Tuesdays in January. And our concert in March is called Broadway Babies. And it's going to be a portion of the proceeds is going to be going to benefit Texas Children's Hospital.
Awesome.
Yeah, we're bringing our chorale together, which is our men's and women's choruses together, singing as the Bayou City Chorale. And the last time folks heard them was in our holiday concert, and more specifically Sing for the Cure last October, where we raised $10,000 for the Houston affiliate of the Komen Foundation.
And when is this going to be again?
This is going to be March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, so come out and hear us.
So you said Broadway.
Yes, Broadway Babies.
Like what? Like Broadway songs?
Best of the Broadway Belter. Broadway Take Magic. Me or Leave Me from Rent.
I have that gene for Broadway.
Yes. Let me tell you, we are going to be celebrating the best of the Big Apple. James is going to put in the music staff. We'll have an incredible program that night. We're going to be doing something from Avenue Q. And just to let people know, the first part of the show, which is going to be focusing on the chorale, is going to be a work called The Old Turtle. And it's based on the children's story, The Old Turtle. And it's been set to music. So the chorale's going to be performing that. It's about a 35-minute work. And we are doing that in conjunction with the Doctors Orchestra of Houston. Hmm. Yes, they're doctors and they play instruments. And we are so excited.
And we're grateful for that.
Exactly. It's amazing. You know, those hands can be used for so many different things. But they are absolutely tremendous organization, and we are so very, very lucky to be working with them. Libby Leibel and the board of directors there voted, you know, unanimously to bring us in on the project. And we're going to be working with them in February, and we're going to be singing parts of Sing for the Cure at their concert on February 15th. And then they, in turn, are going to play for The Old Turtle on March 17th. So it's really a great collaboration. We're really excited about it. And so we'll be doing that for the first half of the show, but then the second half is the guys breaking out Broadway. And it's going to be a great show. It's going to be family friendly. So, you know, anyone with kids can definitely bring them to enjoy all parts of the show. But, you know, there's going to be definitely some strong, you know, great uplifting pieces, and it's going to be an outstanding show.
You had me at Broadway. I'm already there.
Yes. Excellent. Spread the word, everyone. Spread the word.
Well, that's what we're here to do.
I'm hearing this, and I've been here in front of the mic for over 3 years now, and it sounds like you just got so much more going on than you did years past. Is that just my imagination, or what's going on?
Is it the addition of the women's chorus?
Well, certainly having the women has helped us. I mean, having those voices and especially in the GLBT, the women's chorus is integrated, and it's a very diverse. There's gay women, straight women, all different kinds of ethnicities are represented in both choruses, and we're extremely proud of that. But with having the women, it's really created this incredible little family that, you know, we all call it the chorus. And of course, James and I are like mom and dad and talking to everybody and keeping the family going and strong. And we've got a tremendous board of directors. And but having the women, especially when you do the chorale pieces, the men and the women love singing together. And it's this really great friendly competition. Like, I'm going to learn my music faster, and we're going to be ready to go, and our choreography is going to be better. And it's this absolutely fantastic relationship that both choruses have with each other, and they support each other when they're singing individually, and when they come together to sing, it's absolutely outstanding.
Well, it seems to have created an incredible energy that I've noticed, and I'm sure everyone else that's gone and seen the performances can see it too.
Definitely.
It's wonderful.
And the our favorite part of our shows is being able to meet our audiences afterwards. So that's one thing that we've always really enjoyed doing, and catching up with everyone and talking about the shows and how did you like everything and getting to see everyone. And of course, Dalton's always at the event, so it's like prime photo opportunity. Exactly.
You know, it's not an event unless Dalton is there.
That's what I'm saying.
If you get Dalton there, you've made it.
We have. We've reached the big leagues. And yeah. So far, we've been very lucky. He's come to practically everything we've ever done. So we're Dalton territory, and we love it. But no, it's also our 30th anniversary, and so we've been really, James put worked with really hard with the music committee, but really looked to think about shows that would really represent not only us as an organization, but look to the mission that we feel so strongly about, and that's a mission of social justice and equality. And so we're doing, you know, pieces in the Christmas show, but more to the point, you know, looking and doing a concert like Broadway Babies, where we support Texas Children's Hospital. In May, the women are doing a concert called Africa, and we're going to be doing a lot of outreach to the African American community. So there's going to be songs on Africa, the Caribbean, South America, and songs from the African American experience. So really reaching out to that new audience. And then in June, we're doing a show called La Perla, which is going to be a Hispanic and Latino music retrospective. So it's going to have tangos and zarzuelas and just beautiful classic representations of Hispanic and Latino music, but also some contemporary music, you know, Como La Flor. And
I love your, when you bust out your accent.
Hey, oh. You gotta have a little something going on.
Right.
So, but it's, I'm just so excited about the season and what we've got going on.
It's very obvious that you're excited.
Yeah. So, well,
let's review the coming events one more time, giving the times and locations.
I would love to do that. So first, on Saturday, December 2nd, and Tuesday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. at Unity Church on the west side of Houston, which is near the intersection of Hillcroft and Westheimer, we are going to have A Wish for the World, which will feature Bayou City Women's Chorus. And those tickets can be purchased at our website, bayoucityperformingarts.org, or you can call our office at 713-521-7464. Again, that's 713-521-7464. Sing. Yes, 521-SING. You can get a hold of us. If any of you are in the Brenham or Round Top area and would like to come out and see us at Festival Institute, Festival Hill, at Round Top, Texas, we will be there on Saturday, December 13th at 3 p.m. And then on Tuesday, December 16th at 7:30 p.m. at Jones Hall, we will have Winter Song featuring the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston with cameo appearances by the Bayou City Women's Chorus and the Bayou City Chorale. And again, all those tickets can be purchased either through our website at bayoucityperformingarts.org or at 521-SING, 713-521-SING.
If you haven't gone out to one of the concerts by the chorus, you really need to. It's a great treat. It's one of the treasures that we as Houstonians get to experience, and I highly encourage you going out to listen to this treat.
They're much more fun than some others, though.
Absolutely.
So,
thank you for that glowing recommendation. I appreciate that very much.
I've been to plenty of concerts, and they're always different. They're always fun, and they're always just a great group of people. And obviously, people that are very excited about singing and being on stage and performing.
Yes, right. And they are definitely putting their heart and soul into this year. It's like we have a lot to celebrate, even
absolutely.
Though there's been a lot of hardships in the community. There is still a lot to celebrate. So,
absolutely,
want to thank you.
Thank you, Colleen.
Thank you very much.
After Christmas, I pulled on the old rubber gloves and very gently wrung the necks of both the turtle doves.
I kept one of the drummers.
Is Queer Voices.
Turns filmmaker to watch music listeners add their own soundtrack later in the program. Just hours after California's Proposition 8 was approved by the voters, several lawsuits challenging its enforcement were filed with the state Supreme Court. The constitutional amendment that overturned marriage equality passed by a 52-48% margin on November 4th. The lawsuits ask the same court that ruled 4-3 to open civil marriage to same-gender couples to invalidate the measure. They argue that the state's constitution's equal protection provisions do not allow a simple majority to revoke the rights of a targeted minority. Reporter Dan Fritz was in the chambers of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors this week when they voted to join the City of Los Angeles, Santa Clara County, and the City and County of San Francisco in the lawsuits challenging Proposition 8.
Opponents of gay marriage claim this is not a civil rights issue, and the majority has spoken against same-sex marriage. Catherine Lehman, racial justice director of the ACLU of Southern California, disagrees. She was at the Board of Supervisors meeting today.
It was really inspiring.
L.A. City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo was also there, along with his San Francisco counterpart, who both have filed suit with the state Supreme Court to have Prop 8 overturned.
In this nation and in this state, we amend our Constitution to extend rights, not strip them away. Proposition 8 flies in the face of the principle of equal protection and strips away fundamental rights.
The central issue in all the suits against Prop 8 is that the initiative effectively changes the Equal Protection Clause of the state constitution. According to Delgadillo and the other plaintiffs, which include the County of Santa Clara and now L.A. County, an amendment that requires a simple majority is not good enough to make major revisions to the constitution. But the state Supreme Court saw this argument before. Opponents of Prop 8 filed a petition with the court to have the state measure thrown off the ballot on the same grounds.
They declined to even hear that argument because the voters had not spoken yet. They figured that if the voters turn it down, then they wouldn't have to hear the argument because it would be moot. In this case, now it is ripe for them to hear, and we've now brought it directly to the California Supreme Court.
And the city attorney says it's important for city and county lawyers across the state to voice their opposition to Prop 8.
Officers of the court being connected to this lawsuit sends an important message to all involved that this is about justice.
Layman at the ACLU says it was specifically important for L.A. County to stand up against the proposition.
Los Angeles County is the largest county in the state, and it's also a county in which Proposition 8 passed, according to the electorate. So it sends an important message to the court that this county is standing for the principle that the court is the arbiter of what the Constitution means.
Layman relates to the fight for same-sex marriage through her own family's struggle for interracial marriage in the 60s.
My parents were married in Washington, D.C., rather than in Virginia, where my mother was raised, because in 1966, Virginia still outlawed interracial marriage. My mother, who was black, could not at that time marry my father, who was white, in her home state. The United States Supreme Court outlawed race-based marriage restrictions the following year in Loving versus Virginia. And I was raised in the shadow of that decision and the Supreme Court decision in Brown that held that equal protection applies to all persons and that promised a new day of meaningful opportunity for people like me. I cannot imagine that this state would, through the tyranny of a majority vote, wipe away such fundamental constitutional protections.
Supervisors Zev Yaroslavsky, Gloria Molina, and Yvonne Burke, all Democrats, voted in favor of joining the lawsuit. The two Republican members, Don Kanavi and Mike Antonovich, were both absent for the vote. Antonovich had earlier stated he would not support the legal challenge, which he said should have been addressed prior to the election. Delgadillo says the state high court stays out of questions of constitutional conflict whenever possible. But now that the proposition has passed with a narrow majority, Delgadillo says the court will have to address the case.
We have been told that they want to act in an expeditious fashion. I'm hoping that that's something that will happen. When fundamental rights are taken away from any minority group, I believe it's important for us to act swiftly, thoughtfully, but swiftly, and do it right, and make sure that justice is served.
The California Supreme Court voted 4-3 in May that a state ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. That ruling effectively elevated sexual orientation to the constitutional status of race and gender. Plaintiffs in the current suit argued that protected status would be violated by the enactment of Proposition 8. I'm Dan Fritz.
The Asian Pacific American Legal Center, Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Equal Justice Society, California NAACP, and the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund have also challenged Proposition 8 at the California Supreme Court. In a joint press release this week, they argued that minority communities cannot be stripped of their fundamental rights by a simple majority vote. Legal experts say it's hard to predict how the court will act. Even before they rule on the constitutionality of Proposition 8, they could order an immediate stay of its enforcement. That might allow lesbian and gay couples to once again get marriage licenses in the state. But high court justices who will be up for re-election may hesitate to overrule the popular vote. Chief Justice Ronald George participated in a conference on the role of the courts in Berkeley this week. Although the event was not related to the Prop 8 battle, the author of the court's May Marriage Equality Majority Opinion told reporters that the justices are keenly aware that we share with other state courts a vulnerability to forces that focus not on impartiality, but on whether judges, like office holders in our sister branches of government, should be responsive to majoritarian, political, or special interest preferences. If the court upholds the validity of Proposition 8, LGBT advocates promised their own initiative effort in 2010 to overturn it.
Extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website for the latest This Way Out update? For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, just log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Violinist Paul Festa had an unusual idea for a movie, Apparition of the Eternal Church captures the responses of a select group of listeners to French Catholic composer Olivier Messiaen's work of the same name. Festa examines how people listen to music and how secular ears encounter sacred art. Some of those ears included literary critic Harold Bloom, filmmaker John Cameron Mitchell, actor playwright Issa Davis, Broadway drag star Justin Bond, and Scissor's sister singer Animatronic. The film also caught the eye of This Way Out correspondent Dixie Treichel, who asked Festa how the concept was born.
My experience as a violin student at Juilliard, particularly my studies with a harpsichord virtuoso named Albert Fuller, provided the inspiration for this film. I came to him as a chamber music student, so I came with a piano trio, and we would play for him, and he would coach us. And then after our coaching was done, he would invite us over to his West Side studio, and we would listen to music late into the night, and we would talk about it, and it would be more accurate to say that Albert would talk, and we would listen. Mm-hmm. And the kind of stories that he told when we were listening to music, and the experience of having music essentially narrated or elucidated by someone whose imagination was as brilliant as Albert's and as operatic as Albert's, was a great part of my musical education. 10 years, actually, after I left Juilliard, when I first heard this piece by Messiaen, The Apparition of the Eternal Church, which is a 10-minute organ piece that Messiaen wrote when he was 24 years old, when I first heard it, I had this kind of out-of-body response. And my first thought was, when I was capable of thinking anything again, I thought, I have to play this for Albert Fuller. So I did, and I'm really not sure how I got the idea to put the camera on him while he was listening to the music through headphones, but that's what I did. His response was so wonderful. It really ran the gamut of emotion and experience and memory. And when it was through, I was inspired to just keep going and see if I could put together some sort of a film based on people's responses. 2 years later, I had about 115 interviews collected, and out of those interviews, the 31 make up the final film.
When these people were coming in to listen to this, did you give them any instructions prior, or did they just sit down and put the headphones on?
In the film itself, I show a few of the scenes where I'm telling people, it's like, well, this is sort of self-explanatory. Do you know what you're going to do? And there was very little, actually, to tell them because I told them nothing about what they were going to hear.
Okay.
I didn't want people to prepare or start telling me something rather involved about Messiaen or their experience listening. I didn't tell them that it was going to be Messiaen even as I put the music on, or that it was going to be organ music. All they knew was 10 minutes of music and that they should talk essentially through it. You know, it would be fine to take up to a half a minute to just sort of absorb at a time, but generally to try to keep articulating what was going on in their head as they were listening.
There is a path that the film provides for us, how people's emotions are changing with the piece.
Right. The most interesting responses to me were the people who had some kind of a breakthrough during the listening experience. It's the kind of music that's so overwhelming. It's aggressive, it's loud, it's often quite dissonant and uncompromising in various ways. Most music that we listen to, it really isn't emotional in that way. People were embarrassed by it, and people were put off by it because it was asking them to go someplace difficult and deep. So the most gratifying responses for me to watch and to play with later in the editing room were the ones that started off defensive, even dismissive, but at a certain point collapsed under the weight of all of that dramatic energy. And I think that in a certain sense the film does this too. I mean, there are a lot of laughs in the first 25 minutes of the film, and then at a certain point after people have really sort of dropped their defenses, the film does too, and there really aren't any more laughs after mm-hmm. that. Like, you just understand that we've just gone a little deeper, and that the thing that was so funny was really our own response. It wasn't the music itself.
Headphones, I'm also vicariously experiencing being in the same room where this particular music is actually being produced.
If I were in a cathedral listening to this, I would be crying hysterically. I would repent all my sins. God, save me. Save me from what I've done.
That length is what it feels like to be in that moment of, like, about to be killed, about to open a door. A man with giant horns and fire licking up around him
greets you.
It's so emotional. It's like somebody whipping their head back, you know, in anticipation. Their hair, like, flying off their skull.
It's so sexy. It's just like, which I know is not what he means it to be, but that's the way I hear it.
I feel that some of the cords, not all of them, some of the more complicated ones, are attached to my spinal column in some way.
How long does it go on? It's making me very unhappy. 10 minutes of this?
It's going to be 10 minutes of this?
How many more minutes?
6 more minutes?
It's giving me a headache now.
Honey, I'm tired of listening to this.
The people in the film are people who walked into my apartment or whom I had studied with at one place or another, and I was able to get to sit down for this in the sense that it was really just sort of my universe of people, then that's accounted for the large queer quotient. One of the really interesting things to me about looking at the demographics of the group is that here's Messiaen, who's this towering figure, not just in music, but in French Catholicism. I mean, he was the musical voice of French Catholicism for more than half a century. And while French Catholicism isn't maybe the most doctrinaire form of the religion, it's the religion that gave us a number of very difficult responses from the Vatican about homosexuality particularly, and it's a kind of orthodoxy that a lot of us would find really hostile. And yet, when you look at the people in the film whose response to the music is the most deeply felt, and the people who are the biggest Messiaen partisans, it's often like Jewish intellectuals and gay Jewish intellectuals. There really is a special resonance that some of us feel to this profoundly religious, devout music, even if we share, as Michael Warner, the queer English professor, says at some point in his interview, he says, even if we share none of the, what he calls meta-commentary, or just the religious beliefs that underlie the musical output.
There's also a book that's connected with it.
Yes, there is. I'm a big fan of director's commentaries, you know, not just about the film and the making of the film, but the music itself and the specific people that I'd interviewed. When someone's having a very emotional response, and particularly in this case when they're having an emotional response to a piece of music, and an emotion registers on their face, it's really lovely to see it on video. It's even better to see it slowed down in slow motion, which there's quite a bit of in the second half of the film, but it's really great to stop it in the still image. The book is full of these still images, in addition to the full transcript of the film, everything that they've said, and then the director's commentary underneath. Messiaen was born in 1908, so this year is his centenary, and there are concerts and centenary festivals and celebrations happening all over the world all year. The actual birthday is in the second week of December. So I'm touring around with the film. I am also have had the really great pleasure and privilege to give a number of regional premieres, including the U.S. premiere of a Messiaen violin piece that was just published last year. So I'll be playing that in Austin this fall at the Library of Congress as well, in conjunction with the screening of the film.
You can find out more about Paul Festa and his film, Apparition of the Eternal Church, at www.apparitionfilm.com. Thanks to Dixie Trichel for sharing her interview with us. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rex Walken with Phil Kelly, Dan Fritz, Sherry Lunn, and Dixie Trichel contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to postal mail CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, KDHX St. Louis, Missouri, WORT Madison, Wisconsin, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. And you know, I got calls last week about this song. Actually, it's a medley. So I thought I'd play it again for you because everybody seemed to enjoy it so much. This is 3 poofs, actually 4 poofs on a piano, And it's called Extreme 80s from the Screamin' Party Anthem album. That got them dancing in the studio.
Ooh, that was good. I enjoyed that.
That was fabulous. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that album, by the way, the CD, is called Screamin', with the G missing off the end, Screamin' Party Anthems, and it is four poofs and a piano. And, of course,
right.
Our thanks to JD for providing these selections to us.
Oh,
thank you,
yes. JD.
Yeah.
Thanks, JD.
A few housekeeping things. If you want to volunteer at KPFT, there is a volunteer orientation tomorrow, November 18th, between 6 and 7:30 p.m. here at the studios at 419 Lovett Boulevard. And whenever there's an execution in Texas, Ray Hill hosts an execution watch, and that will be tomorrow from 6 to 7 p.m. on the streaming online. It won't be on the regular 90.1, but on the streaming, the extra streaming that's done. And you go to the webpage, kpft.org, for more information. We would like to thank our guests tonight.
What a great show tonight.
Yes.
First of all, we started off with Jerry Simoneau talking about the protest on Proposition 8 and the rally that we had at downtown this past weekend.
And then Ray Hill and my friend Ed Barnes were talking about Harvey Milk. And the movie starts next Wednesday at the River Oaks, a week from this Wednesday at the River Oaks Theater and probably other theaters throughout Houston.
And then there was Colleen Fisher with the Bayou City Performing Arts, and we talked about their upcoming performances of the Women's Choir on Saturday the 6th and Tuesday the 9th, and then the Gay Men's Chorus on the 16th at Jones Hall.
And next week we're going to be talking about World AIDS Day and also Queer Music Heritage.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Like a holiday rock star, making the scene at the office party, the neighborhood progressive dinner, your friend's party, your party with your girlfriend? Do you need something to relieve the party pain? Then ask yourself, can you pass the SNS test? The test occurs Saturday, December 20th, Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, 1031 East 24th Street, just off North Main and south of the North Loop. The SNS test is a Jerry Christmas 2, a celebration of the music of the Grateful Dead, Garcia, and inspired jams. The SNS test is a 90.1 KPFT Houston benefit concert, the cure for other holiday parties. Music will be provided by Plump, the Hightailers, Guy Schwartz, Star Jernigan, Third Ear, the Psychedelos, and many others. Nonstop relief begins at 5 p.m. The door fee is a donation to the station. The relief provided is what you need. See you Saturday, December 20th at the SN Acid Test. It's a dead air production, so what could go wrong? You really want a second opinion? Then take it from these guys.
We wish you a Jerry Christmas. We wish you a Jerry Christmas. We wish you a Jerry Christmas and a happy Bob Weir.
The Pacifica Radio Archives is launching its campus campaign. We're taking our history out of the vault and into the classroom. You donate, and we send a copy of one of our historic compilations to a school or college of your choice.
It's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
From the vault to the classroom, the Pacifica Radio Archives campus campaign launching on Tuesday, November 18th.
This is KPFT, Houston.
Starting the first week of December, KPFT makes a minor program schedule change affecting alternative radio with David Barsamian and exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku. The week of December 1st, alternative radio moves from Wednesdays at 1 p.m. to Thursdays at 1. Exploration switches from its regular Thursday slot to Wednesdays at 1 p.m. This change is intended to ensure KPFT...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.